Welcome to the Institute of Leadership and Management's weekly podcast, where we take a critical look at some topical developments with a leadership and management theme. I'm business and finance journalist Matt Packer, and I'm joined in this endeavour, as always, by the Institute's Head of Research, Policy and Standards, Kate Cooper. Hello there, Kate.
Hello, Matt.
Right, well, I know you're itching to get into the first item on our agenda, so let's dive straight in. A government report published on the 31st of May has highlighted the top 10 worst explanations for why FTSE 350 executives have failed to appoint more women to their boards. The list of lame excuses was compiled by the team behind the landmark Hampton Alexander Review, which has challenged FTSE 350 firms to ensure that by 2020, at least a third of their board members and leadership figures are women. Gems in this chart of shame include: I don't think women fit comfortably into the board environment. All the good women have already been snapped up. Most women don't want the hassle or pressure of sitting on a board. And we have one woman already on the board, so we're done. It's someone else's turn. What do you make of all this?
Well, I think my favourite one there is about all the good women having been snapped up.
It's a gem, isn't it?
If all the women have been snapped up, then obviously it seems that they're having to fill the remaining posts with less than good men. But there's this sort of idea there's a finite supply of good women. But one of the things I was emphasising when the gender pay gap statistics were published, please let's not ask people to explain them, because this is the sort of nonsense you get by way of explanation.
Yeah.
It's great that they've been published because they are ridiculous and they are drawing attention to those excuses. But the real energy and effort has to go into explaining the business case for why you need more women in senior positions. So in that way, I think it's perhaps shamed some people into saying, oh, goodness, do we really say and think those things, and thinking, hopefully, and saying different things. So I think overall it's a good thing to see them. And also it's very amusing.
It is very amusing. And the thing that struck me immediately when I read them was that they're the sort of explanations or excuses that can only really be invented by people who know that they don't really have any place to hide anymore.
It does really show you, especially the comments about, well, we can't find any women. It's how those networks, especially in director roles, that it's very informal, the way they contact each other. So you can almost imagine, well, all the good women have gone because we don't know anymore.
Absolutely.
And they need to find ways of accessing the networks, which will give them a rich seam of good women.
Yes. Okay, in our second item, which we have spotlighted in a News and Views blog on the Institute's website, Justice Secretary David Gork has unveiled a major new initiative to improve the employability of ex-offenders. Under the Ministry of Justice Education and Employment Strategy, a vocational training route called the Prisoner Apprenticeship Pathway will offer offenders guaranteed jobs upon release. A new futures network will matchmake prisoners with employers to cut the £15 billion cost of reoffending. And employers will be encouraged to change their attitudes towards people who've served time from shop floor to boardroom. What kind of responsibilities would you say this initiative places on the shoulders of not just ex-offenders, but leaders too?
This is a great initiative, and of course the benefits to society of schemes like this work are terrific. We've already had the example of Timpson's that has that very open policy about employing ex-offenders, and Timpson's aren't alone there. There are many other organisations that exist to help this happen. But it can't be done cheaply. It has to be resourced. And just getting somebody a job is not the end of it. It's supporting them and keeping them in that job and helping them acquire all those going to work skills that if you spent a number of years in prison, you haven't been acquiring. It's not the same as somebody else who's not got that sort of background, their first day of work. Of course, they need support, but I think it's a different and much less targeted sort of support than these individuals might need. Research that we've done about those first few days in a job show how important it is for everybody that you get induction, you get onboarding right. And that's where you create the sense in these individuals that they're going to succeed, it's going to be okay, they're going to have the help and support they need. And I think that's where the real resources need to be focused.
And this is very much in the area of role modelling.
It is. It's nothing more compelling, is there, than somebody talking to you about how they've done it, how they've succeeded, and yes, you can emulate them. but not leaving them on their own to sink or swim and treating them as though, oh, well, we've given you a fresh start, off you go. It's far more than that that they need to make these sorts of schemes successful. The prison population is full of people who've already been there before. Mm. So the budget that pays for this and supports it will not be the budget that sees the benefits from these people not coming back. So it's taking a very holistic view as to doing this properly could be brilliant.
Yeah, it's very much a root and branch approach. Next up, we're turning to the perennial workplace theme of body language, and this item has also been showcased in one of our News and Views blogs. In a 24th of May interview with Forbes, body language expert Amy Cuddy, who is a Harvard Business School professor, argues that women should manage their physical postures more effectively at work to overcome confidence problems. In Cuddy's assessment, powerful people take up more space, and she says there's no question that men do this more than women, not just in terms of posture, but with how they speak too. For Cuddy, this means that men seem more competent than women. Now, my question here is that in a workplace environment that is gradually waking up to neurodiversity and therefore welcoming individuals who communicate socially in different ways, is Cuddy's one-size-fits-all view of body language outdated?
I think we've seen pictures of those power poses, and it's Wonder Woman that does it particularly well. And yes, thinking about your presence and how you occupy a physical space is, of course, really important. But the norm being, let's see what men do and try and do the same as them, and therefore any women not doing a similar thing is somehow in deficit. Why should that be the norm? My question really is, why aren't we renegotiating the norm? And why do we celebrate overconfidence and chastise or criticise a lack of confidence, when actually what we might be saying is, let's be a bit more realistic, because overconfidence is just as, if not more, damaging than underconfidence. So it's rethinking what we think normal is. As we hear more about neurodiversity, more about how people communicate differently, we can't just say that everybody uses body language in the same way. It's so much about understanding the person you're talking to and modifying your message accordingly. So it's being mindful, I think, rather than being prescriptive.
And being more kind of pluralistic.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, body language is obviously very important on the football field, which leads us on to our fourth and final item. Liverpool FC coach Jurgen Klopp has signalled that the side will stand by its embattled goalkeeper Loris Karius following its horrific 3-1 defeat to Real Madrid in the Champions League final. Now, according to the Liverpool Echo, Klopp wants the team to help Karius overcome his ordeal, saying, quote, "The mistakes were obvious. We don't have to talk about them. They are all clear. He knows it, I know it, you all know it. Now he has to deal with it, we have to deal with it. We will do that, we will be with him, no doubt about that." Close quote. Now, what do you think other leaders can learn from Klopp's approach here?
Well, I think, having spoken to a Liverpool supporter soon after the game, and her view was that you can't sing "We'll Never Walk Alone" and then let somebody go and not support them. The interesting thing here is it's a real calling out the sports psychologists who say it's all about mental toughness and resilience, because it's undoubtedly this person has goalkeeping skills. It's whether he can come back from this sort of awful defeat and show that mental toughness and resilience that we hear that can be developed, it can be coached, it can be trained, and then have the confidence to match the skills that he undoubtedly has. And that's the challenge for the coach. And that's why I'm watching this with real interest, because I do think it's a real test of the extent to which you can coach, help and support mental toughness and resilience.
Yeah, I'm very interested in how you picked up on the "You'll Never Walk Alone" motto. It's almost as though there's an authenticity test here for Liverpool.
Oh, there is. And for all the sports psychologists who do believe, and there's obviously a lot of evidence to support this, that you can improve your resilience and your mental toughness.
Yeah, excellent. Okay, well, that concludes this week's episode. Listeners can find further topical content in the News and Views section of the Institute's website, which can be found at www.institutelm.com. That's www.institutelm.com. Thank you very much indeed for your insights, Kate. I look forward to exploring a new set of stories with you next week.
Great. Thanks, Matt.